The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Now, we have to actually conclude one issue which we were discussing yesterday. We were talking about the concept of carrying. And I mentioned to you, just, you know, maybe by way of review, I mentioned yesterday that one of the obstacles to our relationship to Shabbat is that we view Shabbat as a series of don'ts. And we looked in the Bible and we saw that the essential commandment, the essential verse that deals with Shabbat tells me, right, Sheishit Amim Tavod Vasita Kol Melachtecha, right? 6 days you can, or as we mentioned yesterday, really you should do all your labor. You should make something of the world. And on the seventh day, Shabbat Lashem Elokecha is Shabbat to God. Lo taseh kol melacha. You don't do any melacha. You don't do any labor. So we said, all right, we have to figure out what labor is. So we concluded very quickly that labor is not work as we think of it, because I can move tables around and work up a sweat, at least biblically inside the house, but I can't even carry a feather outside the house. So we quoted Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, who said that really it's a question of productivity. To take an object, and we actually used one of Mr. Charles's favorite examples, as you will discover this Thursday night, to take a piece of dough and to make it into challah. So I'm taking something and I'm making something of it, I'm making something of the world. And we said that one day a week, we remember that we're not only creators, but partners in creation. We are really created as well. And therefore, one day a week, I focus on a different level of creativity, on a spiritual creativity, and I remove myself to a certain extent from physical productivity. Okay? And then we concluded our class by saying, this all is very well and good. And it fits with all the malachot. I don't turn on a light switch because I'm essentially closing a circuit or whatever it is. And I'm bringing light into the world. And one day a week I remember that I'm not in control of the world, which is a danger. So, we said that the difficulty is carrying. And I mentioned to you that carrying fits into this theme in terms of the fact that carrying establishes ownership. That when I carry something, essentially I'm making a statement that this belongs to me. And one day a week, it's good to remember that it doesn't really belong to you. As a matter of fact, I remember Milton Steinberg. Milton Steinberg, brilliant, brilliant author. He was a conservative rabbi in America. You can see actually, and again, I don't like labels, but just for the picture. And you can see in his writings that wherever he was at, he became much, much more religiously, philosophically involved towards the end of his life. He died at a very young age, in his mid-50s, of a massive heart attack. And he wrote a magnificent essay, which he was actually written 6 weeks. He was the major heart attack that he had before the heart attack that killed him put him in the hospital for 6 weeks. When he got out of the hospital, and he was back in the synagogue, he was obviously very weak. And they wanted him to give a sermon on Shabbat morning, and he said he was too weak. But he said, I'll tell you one thing. He said, Chabek et ha'olam. Embrace the world. Ach bizro'ot p'tuchot. But with open arms. You have to be willing to let it go. We live in a world which is all too temporary. And one of the greatest challenges we have is to recognize what we're really here for. What is it that we want to accomplish in this world? What do we feel we can do? What is our real contribution? And that's very much a part of Shabbat. And the concept that I don't carry out of a certain domain very much relates to that. Because it tells me that I have to focus on what my domain really is. But we left off with one detail that I didn't get to mention. So I apologize to anybody who wasn't here in yesterday's class, but I mentioned to you that there are two types of biblical carrying. There is carrying from a private to a public domain, and then there is carrying in a public domain. And I said that if you carry in a public domain, in order to be biblically liable, as it were, to have, by definition, carried, you have to carry a certain distance, right? If I'm in a public domain, you ever see the Carol Burnett show? There used to be this guy, Tim Conway, and his big act, he would come out on the stage, right? And it amazes me, actually, now that I actually laughed at this, but I guess, you know, in my youth. And he would come out on the stage, and this is what he would do. right? He would just like, you know, the whole audience would be waiting, and some woman would be waiting for some important meeting or whatever it was, and he'd just come like this. And that was his big act. And this was immensely funny, right? For whatever the reason. So I always think of that, like, if he does that, is he carrying? He's moving, he's carrying something. So it's very difficult to define what carrying is. So the Talmud says, no, I have to carry 4 cubits. What is 4 cubits? How does that fit in? So this is an unbelievable idea. I'll give you an example. Here, Phil, come here. You're the victim. It's easiest for you to get up. Okay? Did you ever meet a guy? Okay? You ever meet a guy, and you know, or someone, whatever, and they're speaking to you, and they kind of like, they do this. So how you doing? How's it going, man? It's really good to see
nice
you.
To see you.
Yeah. And like, you become a little uncomfortable, you know, right? So at first you go like this, yeah, really? Then you're like, you know, yeah, it's really nice to see you, you know? Just thinking about why. Because you have a certain body space. And it's interesting, the sociologists discuss what your body space is. You could sit now, right? And you have a certain, I'm leaving him hanging there, right? Yeah, very interesting. You have a certain body space. And if you enter a person's body space, it's almost as though you're invading their space. And it's interesting, by the way, that different relationships allow for different spaces. And you give messages of communication, which relates to what we said in our introduction to mitzvot, based on those body spaces, right? A stranger. If you're sitting at a, if you're standing at a bus stop, and a stranger enters within a certain distance of you, so you're very concerned about this. You could view this as a threat. You could view it as odd. You could be curious about it, right? If a person that you're friendly with comes a little closer, well, you give them a little more space invasion, but up to a point. And of course, someone you love, so you invite them into your space, that's part of your relationship, right? Now, this is reflected, by the way, in Jewish halakha. I'll give you an example. I'll give you an example. If you're praying, there's a beautiful, beautiful halakha. If you're praying, you're not supposed to walk, right? Remember, we mentioned at one point the Shemona Esrei, which is the central prayer, the central theme of tefillah. If I'm praying, you're not supposed to walk into my space. So the halacha says, what is considered my space? Want to guess? 4 cubits. If I find, and it's interesting because people do this all the time, you know, especially, you know, when I was in the yeshiva world, so most people know this halacha, they know this rule, that you shouldn't, you know, if somebody's, I mean, somebody's in the middle of this incredible experience, it makes a lot of sense, and they're communicating with God, and they're in deep prayer, and they're thinking about, you know, the universe, and magnificence, and the world, and world hunger, and peace, and community, and everything, and then this guy walks in, goes, ah, oh, sorry, right, and there it goes. So you don't walk into a person's space, and it's interesting, by the way, that this space is not just in front of a person, but in back of a person, on the side of a person. And if 4 cubits is about 8 feet, it makes you realize that if people are in the middle of this prayer, you really can't walk into the synagogue. Right? If somebody's doing what I call the yeshiva shuffle, you know, they don't want to go, right? So they kind of like slide in between. So that doesn't work. The Aruch HaShulchan, by the way, this was a halacha that amazed me. The Aruch HaShulchan, famous Lithuanian commentator from about 150 years ago, he says an unbelievable thing. He says that if you look at somebody, if you look at somebody when they're praying Shemona Esrei, you're invading their space. You're not supposed to look someone in the face. And you know this is true, right? If you look at someone, you invade their space, right? You can look at someone, and they're just like, you know, if somebody's lightly sleeping, you can stare at them and wake them up, right? So you're not supposed to invade somebody's space. And there are all sorts of halachic ramifications. I'll give you one more example. If I find something, at what point does it become mine? According to one opinion, if it's within my space, and someone else sees it at the same time, but they're further away from it, if it's within 4 cubits of me, it's mine. Because it's in my space. So essentially, the reason that when I carry in a public domain, I have to carry 4 cubits in order to have considered myself to have carried, is because that's my space. So within that 4 cubits, it's already in my control. The real exhibition of control that I demonstrate on an object is when I move 4 cubits and take it into a new area of space. That, by the way, is the reason why in my house I can carry at will, because I'm not affecting any change in the ownership or the demonstration of ownership of the object, because it's already in my space in my home. Okay? So I just thought that that was very important to mention. Okay. And this fits with another idea, but maybe we'll get to it later. Now, I want to take you to a different story entirely. Okay? Let's say that your name is Robinson Crusoe. Okay? and you were on this great cruise, and it got messed up. And you're stuck on a desert island. And you have this incredible dilemma. What's your dilemma? What's your big dilemma? You're on a desert island. What's your big dilemma? Oh, no, forget the last topic. Ooh, like, oh, yeah, how are we supposed to... Oh, yeah, what's your space, man? No, you're sitting on a desert island. Right? There you go. It's not food, it's not water, it's nothing like that, because that doesn't concern you, because you've been an Israelite. Your big dilemma is Shabbat. Now, what if you don't know what day it is? What if you don't know what day it is? Well, you can't look it up in a calendar. You can't, what do you do? What do?
Every day.
You don't know what day it is. That's very interesting. In fact, it's so interesting that no one in the Talmud says it. You know why? You know why? And I once thought of that. I thought, oh, that'd be a great thing. No, it's a very good question. Because if I kept Shabbat every day, then I know that I wouldn't be violating Shabbat. And yet the Talmud does not suggest this as a possibility. Anybody want to venture a guess as to why? Yeah? Because my Shabbat is not a lonely unit. It's part of a whole process. And if I haven't gained anything during the week, it will affect my Shabbat. David Epstein's concerns with regards to Shabbat this past weekend were very real. If I have a different kind of a week, so then there's something in my Shabbat that may not be achieved. Consequently, I need my six-day week to achieve a Shabbat. They're part and parcel. So I've got two possibilities. The Talmud tells me there are two possibilities. Anybody want to venture a guess as to what those two possibilities are? Okay, I count 6 days. I don't know about working, whatever, you're on a desert island. Okay, boss, right? I mean, you know, you ask your man Friday what day is Shabbos. He doesn't know, but never mind. Right? But okay, that's one possibility. It needs work. You count, the nigam is okay. You count your 6 days, right? And you celebrate Shabbat. What's the other possibility? How could you wait 6 days to celebrate Shabbat? I mean, what if... So, right that day you celebrate Shabbat. That evening is Friday night, you daven Kabbalat Shabbat, whatever it is, and then you count 6 days, you keep another Shabbat, etc., 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 etc. Okay. Now, forget the halachic ramifications, the legal ramifications. Is it biblical? Is it rabbinic? Forget that. The rabbis have a difference of opinion, and the ruling doesn't matter to me. There are differences of opinion, and those differences of opinion flow down a long way in halachic source so that it's very difficult to come to a conclusion. So this fascinates me as an issue. But you know what fascinates me about this most? I think to myself, okay, the Talmud was written, it was put together at least, between the 2nd and 5th centuries CE. This was a very difficult time in Jewish history, right? I mean, this was the height of the Roman Empire and the decline of Rome and rise of Christianity. Things were not so easy for the Jews. So what are the rabbis, they have nothing better to do than sit around discussing what would be if one guy gets stuck on a desert island, what would he do about Shabbos? If a guy gets stuck on a desert island, he's got bigger issues to deal with than whether or not it's Shabbos. Well, what are they talking about here? Why does this occupy space in the Talmud? Who cares? What do you do if you are tying your shoelaces and somebody throws a frisbee at you made of matzah and it's the night of Passover and you want to know whether you should make a blessing? I mean, it's a good question if it happens to you, but it's not top on the priority list. So what are the rabbis doing here? More interesting to me. What are they debating? I mean, okay, so you have a question. So they get into a whole debate. Oh, good question. If you have 6 days and maybe one and two, how do we resolve? They start bringing proofs and back and forth. Let's have a discussion. Bring over the students. You could picture them in the basement. I mean, it must have been a really boring afternoon. And what's going on here? So here comes the light bulb. Ding. This is an essential part of Torah learning. Whenever I see a debate, I have to ask myself one very, very important question. What is the most important thing to resolve when you see a debate in the Talmud? What are they really arguing about? What are they really talking about? What's the debate? What does it mean? So, in order to respond to that, I have to clue you into something. See, all these classes we've been having, I hope you've been enjoying them. They've been a delusion. All of them. Because I've only been telling you half the story. Right? I said we're going to learn the Ten Commandments as a part of our mitzvot. And I told you, what page are we on?
86.
But that's not entirely true. Because you see, the Ten Commandments are repeated in the Torah twice. Mm-hmm. This is mind-boggling. But that's not what's mind-boggling. You want to know what's really mind-boggling? Let's take a look at the second version of the Ten Commandments. Now, open up to Deuteronomy, okay? We're in Deuteronomy chapter 5, verse 8. And we mentioned this yesterday. Zachor et yom ha-shabbat lekadsho. Right? What does that mean? Remember the Sabbath day, right? Now comes along the second version. Now I have to give you a little background. I have to give you a little background here. You ready for some background? You're always ready for some background, right? I have to give you a little background. This second version of the Ten Commandments, I mean, what's the obvious question here? Right? Like, what? Like, we forgot? It's a little strange. So I got to give you some background. Because this is a very powerful era that we're dealing with in the book of Deuteronomy. Moses is standing before the entire Jewish people. And they are on the banks of the Jordan River. Just about. I have to tell you, it's very interesting that if you look at the progression of the Torah, this is the progression of the Torah. You watching? This is the progression of the Torah. It starts out wide, and it gradually just narrows in. The first, for example, portion of the Torah, Genesis. So, if science is correct, is hundreds of millions, even billions of years. Right? The second portion, the whole story of Noah. So that's like, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years. It's only in the third portion, the story of Abraham, that I start to focus on like decades. And the second half, really, the book of Genesis, takes us through something like 400 years. Right? And then I get to the story of Exodus. And the story of Exodus, the book of Exodus, really, is, you know, some year, maybe 39 years, through the book of Numbers. The book of Deuteronomy, possibly, is one day. The whole book. The whole book is Moshe's swan song. Moses was an incredibly tragic figure when you start to think about it. He spent his whole life bringing the Jewish people out of the land of Egypt. He took them through Sinai. And everything that was involved. And he did what? All of this in order to bring them to the land of Israel. And they're finally about to enter the land of Israel. And that's it. Moses dies and Joshua takes over. It's tragic. And Moshe says in the second portion of the book of Deuteronomy, Va'etchanan el Hashem ba'itahi. And I did beg God, Ebra na v'ereh. Please let me go over and see this land. Ha'aretz hatov. You know, we don't appreciate this. We pay our $600, $700, $800, we get on a plane, and we walk around. Moses couldn't do that. It's an unbelievable thing. So Moshe is now speaking to the entire Jewish people, and he's essentially saying goodbye. And the whole book of Deuteronomy is a soliloquy. Now there's one very important detail. Moshe is talking now to the second generation. Remember that because of the sin of the spies, whatever that means, the entire first generation, at least that was of a certain age and contemplation, has passed on. They don't enter the land of Israel. These are their children. This is the generation that did not grow up as slaves. They weren't born into the assumption of slavery. They grew up in the desert as a free and an independent nation. It's very interesting that the modern state of Israel very much parallels this experience. This nation was built by those people who came out of the camps and came out of the suffering. And today we are now in a generation which has grown up with the assumption of Jewish independence, of a Jewish state. And that's why there's so many identity issues in the modern state of Israel. So Moshe is speaking to the second generation. And he's essentially saying to them, before you go into the land, I want to talk to you. I want to tell you why you're going into the land, what we're doing here. So you would imagine then that it makes a lot of sense. He's going to repeat to them. He's going to say, 40 years ago, I went up the mountain. All of your fathers and mothers and brothers and sisters, the older ones, they stood at the bottom. And I gave the Ten Commandments. And I'm going to give you now the Ten Commandments. just before you enter the land of Israel, because that's how a Jew enters the land of Israel. I have to tell you a quick story. Maybe sometime I'll tell you the whole story, but I have a very close friend. His name is Zach Baumel. He's been missing in action in Lebanon since 1982 in the Battle of the Valley of Tears, Sultan Yaakov. And his story is it's a tragic story. His parents have been through the 7 levels of hell. Anyway, one of the boys missing from that battle is a boy named Yehuda Katz. And once, because they used to invite me, it's actually how I got to Israelite, they used to invite me to come speak whenever they had a parlor meeting or a get-together, because I knew him very well. We were together in the dorm. And he was one of the guys who took me under his wings as a young, kind of raw American in the yeshiva. So I would like come and speak about it, and you know. Once in Male Adumim, they invited a boy who had been through the battle. He was actually in the battle, and he was very close with Yehuda Katz, who was one of the other boys from a different yeshiva, Karen Biavne, who was still missing from that battle. And he told us an unbelievable story. He said that when the bus came, and I remember this night vividly, I remember I was in the Beit Midrash in Gush, in Har Etzion, it was a Sunday night, and Rav Amital, the Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the yeshiva, came into the Beit Midrash. It was about 7:30 at night. And of course, you know, we knew that there was a war on. It started early that morning at about 5 in the morning. There had been shelling of Katyusha rockets in the north all weekend. I remember we sat on the bus Saturday night and listened to the interviews. Right? We knew something was up. I had been in Ranana for Shabbos. And we knew something was up as soon as we got on the bus, because everybody was quiet and nobody was pushing. And the news was blaring. And they were interviewing children who had been in bomb shelters all weekend. So at 5 in the morning, the Israeli army decided to invade Lebanon. And they went across the border, and that entire day, I remember I was sitting in yeshiva, and the yeshiva where I studied, there were about 600-700 guys. We came back, there were only about 200 guys. Most of them had been called up over the weekend. And they were playing and screaming overhead, back and forth, all day. So you knew what was going on. That night, Rav Amital, the Rosh Yeshiva, walked into the Beit Midrash. Now, he was never there at night. I don't think I've ever seen him, unless it was a special occasion, like a holiday or something. So everybody knew something was up. As soon as he walked into the Beit Midrash, the whole Beit Midrash went quiet. And he walked up to the central platform, and he banged on the platform to get everybody. And he said, all the 4th and 5th year students who had not yet been called up, go back to your rooms, pack a bag, there'll be a bus coming to take you north in 30 minutes. And that was it. And he walked out. And there was this like collective silence in the basement. And then one by one, the guys started getting up and closing their gemaras, and, you know, thinking their last thoughts. And most of us went out with them to their rooms to say goodbye to them. And I remember I went into Zach. I was talking to Zach and Arye Cohen, another guy. And I remember, as a matter of fact, he came out the last time that I saw him. He was kidding around. He came out with this little knapsack, and he had a pair of like shower shoes tied onto the knapsack. I said to him, like, you know, and I hadn't been in the army. I said, "You're going to war with shower shoes?" Right? He said, "Ah, that's the most important thing." And that's how he left. Anyway, Yehuda Katz, the same night, the bus came to take the boys from Karen Biavne to the same unit. And everybody was getting on the bus. And Yehuda Katz had to go to the bathroom. He had to go to the bathroom. So he ran off to go to the bathroom, you know. Sounds like a mundane thing. We're going to war and the music is playing. Dum da dum dum da da dum dum. Have to go to the bathroom, excuse me, right? But that's life. So he goes to the bathroom. When he gets out of the bathroom and everybody's like waiting, he runs off in the other direction. In the direction of the Beit Midrash, or the house of study. And like everybody's on the bus, and there's a war, and we're going up to war, and 2 minutes pass, 4 minutes pass, 5 minutes pass, and finally Yehuda Katz comes running back. So this buddy of his, when he gets on the bus and they sit down together, he says, "What are you doing? Well, where'd you go? Everybody's waiting." He says, "You don't go to war from a bathroom. You go to war from a Beit Midrash." So he ran to the Beit Midrash and he learned something quickly, and that's how he went off to war. Very powerful idea. So Moses says to the Jewish people, to the second generation, if you're going to enter the land of Israel, this is where you have to enter the land of Israel from. From Torah, from what it means, from where it touches you deep inside. And so I'm going to give you the Ten Commandments again. And that's what Moshe is doing. And it's an incredible idea, except for one little problem. Look at the beginning of the fourth commandment, verse 12. Shamor et Yom HaShabbat Lekadsho. Right? What does that mean? Shamor. Keep. Guard the Sabbath day. Look at the beginning of this commandment. In the previous Ten Commandments, Zachor, remember the Sabbath day. Hello! I mean, okay, I understand, you know, it's 40 years. What happened? You forgot? Like, I expect somebody in the audience to say, no, it was Zachor. Remember. And I'm like, hello, remember. So what's going on here? How come the version's different? And by the way, if my perspective, as I've shared with you, is correct, that these Ten Commandments are not Moshe getting some kind of an idea. In other words, I once had a very interesting discussion with someone who considered himself an authority on biblical criticism. I don't consider myself an authority on biblical criticism. I don't even consider myself that knowledgeable in biblical criticism. But we were having this discussion. He brought up the Ten Commandments as an example. He says, if you want to really see a proof, we got into a whole discussion of the definition of proof, but if you want to really see a proof for the fact that there are more than one author in the Bible, so look at the Ten Commandments. The first time it says Zachor, remember. The second time it says Shamor, two different authors. Now my perspective is completely different, and that's why I told you in our first class of Torah study that it really all depends on the perspective. Because my perspective is not there are two different authors, but since there's one author, so why is there a difference? Because I want you to know, I don't perceive this as Moshe sort of fumfering and fumbling with the words. If this is divine, and if God gave these Ten Commandments to Moshe, and tells him, listen, this is going to last for the next 4,000 years. And if in fact God is doing the same thing here to the second generation, then why does God change the word? Why are there two versions? What's the difference between the first and the second? And in fact, let's go further. Because let's look at these two versions and see if there are any other difference. And here comes another rule of Torah study. Whenever I find, and you find this all over the Bible, whenever I find that a story is repeated, it's crucial to study the different versions and to note the differences and to be challenged by what those differences mean. I'll give you an example. When Abraham sends Eliezer, his servant, to find a wife for Isaac. So first the Bible tells me the story of what happens. And then, first the Bible tells us that Abraham tells Eliezer what to do. Then the Bible tells me that Eliezer actually goes and does it, and there's certain differences. Then Eliezer comes back, and he repeats the story to Abraham. So I've got three different versions of the same story. Why do I need that? I mean, if this is really divine, why is the Torah telling me the same story three times? It must be that there's some incredible message that I'm supposed to glean from each version. So if that's true for a story, how much more so is it true for the Ten Commandments? So I got to figure out what's going on here. So let's take a look. Now look at the first version. Remember the Sabbath day. 6 days you work and do all your labor, right? Okay, now you got your finger up top. Now look at the second day. Keep, whatever that means, the Sabbath, right? We're in verse 12. Ka'asher tzivcha Hashem Elokecha, as the Lord your God has commanded you. Okay, so that makes sense. Because this is the second time I'm seeing it. Okay. Sheshet yamim ta'avod ve'asita kol melachtecha. Same verse, right? 6 days you shall labor and do all your, right? Work, do all your labor? Okay. And the seventh day is Shabbat to Hashem. And then it goes into this whole discussion. Look at verse 14. Now we're in the second set of the Ten Commandments, since we're already there. Don't do any labor. Ata, you. Uvincha uvitecha, your son and daughter. And by the way, if you look in the Hebrew here, in verse 14, you'll note that there's a little hyphen between bincha ubitecha, son and daughter. Right? Do you see that? That's because this is one unit. There's no difference. In other words, in parts of this list, there are differences. Right? Servants come after your own children. But son and daughter, it's very interesting, are one unit. Va'avdecha va'amatecha. And your manservant and your female servant. Same thing, one unit. No difference between a female servant and a manservant. Vishorcha. And your ox, v'chamorcha, and your donkey, v'chol b'emtecha, and all of your animals. Now, what's going on here? What's going on here? My donkey has to keep Shabbos? What does that mean? Wilbur, it's been a long week. What does that mean? Why does the donkey? I understand here, we're not, you know. Well, this isn't some story somebody starts a class with to get you interested. This is God making sure that Moses, before the Jewish people go into the land of Israel, tells them, make sure your donkey keeps the Sabbath. So what does that mean? Okay. And look at the end of this verse. V'gercha asher b'sharecha, and the stranger who's in your gates. What we're referring to here, interestingly enough, is a convert. A ger is a convert. What kind of a convert, how that works, that's a more detailed discussion, but a convert. Someone who has embraced Judaism. So even he keeps Shabbat. Huh? What do you mean even he? He's converted. He's a ger. Or maybe it doesn't mean that. There's a difference of opinion. Maybe it means a ger toshav, a Canaanite who's accepted upon himself the seven laws of Noah. And that Canaanite is a stranger in your gates because he lives in the land of Israel, but he's not a Jew, he's a stranger. Okay. Either way, there's still something that bothers me. Look at the verse. Look at the whole verse, even in the English. What bothers you? Yeah. Like you, your children, your slaves, your animals, oh yeah, and the stranger. So the rabbis say, in fact, it's the opposite. It's very interesting. One of the lessons you learn from the sin of the spies, right? Spies come back. You ever hear the song, Eretz Avat Chalav? Is that right? The land of milk and honey. Nobody realizes that the authors of that song were the spies. The 10 spies who convinced the Jewish people not to enter the land of Israel, because of whom we wandered the desert for 40 years. Not exactly top on the hit list parade of Judaism. They were the ones who said a land of milk and honey. You know why no one remembers that that's what they said? Because after they tell this beautiful, it's almost a song how they speak about the land of Israel, they say Ephes, ki az ha'am. But the people are so strong, the Canaanites will never enter the land. And there's a very powerful lesson you learn from the sin of the spies. You always remember what comes after the but. Do you ever have a conversation with someone? And you walk into the office, I don't know, you're working for them. And they call you into the office, you're having a discussion, say, listen, I want you to know, you're very good. And you do a tremendous job. What are you waiting for? You're waiting for the but. Right? You just know it's coming. And if it doesn't come, you're kind of like, huh? You can't figure it. Then you're waiting for it. So you're waiting for the but. What I learned from that, beyond that particular rule, is that people will remember what you leave them with. That's why it's so important. How you greet a person and how you depart from a person. That's why the mezuzah is at the door. Because that's how I leave my home, with Torah. And when you look at the concept of departures in Judaism, they are very significant. And there are all sorts of things that I do when I make a departure, when I finish learning something, when I complete a whole section of Talmud, I have a whole seal. I conclude it, because a conclusion is the ultimate level in terms of memorization, internalization, etc. Inculcation. So, Moshe now is talking to the Jewish people. They are departing the desert. And therefore, this whole speech is how they depart the desert. Here, we're departing the list. And the rabbis say, I finish with the ger, because that's the most crucial part of the list. Because the stranger, and now either way, whether it's the Canaanite or the Jew who's converted, it's crucial that this person be made to feel equal somehow, a part of my Shabbat, right? A part of my Shabbat is centered around this idea. This idea, number one, that the stranger be made to feel as though he is in my gates. Now, it's an interesting thing. A ger is meant to feel as a Jew. But a Jew is supposed to remember that somebody is a ger, that somebody is a convert. Now, that doesn't make sense. Because you want to forget that a person is a convert. No, not true. Because if a person is a convert, it means that they have certain sensitivities. And if I forget that person's past and who that person is, then I lose that ability to be sensitive to that person. That's why he's Bisharecha, he's in my gates, but he's a convert. And I have to make that extra effort to bring him in. The animals. What do the animals have to do with my Shabbat? And now it gets even interesting. What's this whole list for? Why am I concerned that my slaves, whatever that means, that my slaves, by the way, you have to make yourself a promise. Everybody here has a stereotype about what a slave is. I promise you that whatever your perception of a slave is completely antithetical to the Jewish idea of a slave. The Jewish idea of slavery is a magnificent idea. It's a beautiful idea. It's nothing to do with slavery and African Americans enslaved and Jews in concentration camps and whatever else it is. So if you're curious about that during our question and answer session or whenever, I'll be glad to mention it, not right now. But it's important to me in the course of this discussion that you remove that stereotype. Okay? However, part of my Shabbat, right? Part of my Shabbat is animals. And now the Bible comes along and tells me, the whole purpose of Shabbat is that I should allow my maidservant, my handservant, to rest like me. And in fact, the Bible goes on. V'zacharta, look at verse 50. V'zacharta, and remember, ki eved hayita be'eretz Mitzrayim. Remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. V'yotziyacha Hashem Elokecha misham, and God took you out of there. B'yad chazaka, he's running to Yah with a strong hand. And therefore, al king, tzivcha Hashem Elokecha lasot et yom Shabbat. And therefore, God did command you to make Shabbat, to have Shabbat, to be at one with Shabbat. Somebody ask me an obvious question. Let me ask you a question. Why do I keep Shabbat? Why do I have Shabbat? So now we've got three excellent points. Okay? First of all, why is Egypt connected to Shabbat? Second of all, why do I need a reason for Shabbat? And third of all, what does this mean? What is this sensitivity of Egypt and servitude and me and Shabbat? How does this work? Okay, excellent. Why do I celebrate Shabbat? Well, I'll give you a hint. Why did they celebrate Shabbat for 40 years in the desert? Now let's say that you're now Benny Friedman, you're sitting here, and you're thinking, ooh, where do I take this class now? Where do I do this? Well, why did they celebrate Shabbat for 40 years in the desert? Well, where would I find in the text why the Jews celebrated Shabbat for 40 years in the desert? In the first Ten Commandments. Oh, so let's look in the first Ten Commandments. Why did they celebrate Shabbat in the first Ten Commandments? Look back at the first Ten Commandments. Right? Look at verse 10. The Yom HaShavi'i Shabbat L'Hashem Elokecha. Right? And the seventh day, Shabbat to Hashem. Same as the second set. Lo tasek omlecha, don't do labor, ata, you, bincha, bitecha, v'decha, v'matecha, v'emtecha. Ooh. Look at this. Just animals. Doesn't say your ox, your donkey. It's a little less specific. Maybe Moshe wanted to give a commentary. He was like getting into it. You know, yeah, your oxes and your donkeys. Oh, incredible, right? He's getting into it, right? I don't think so, right? And then I get the gear. And then I get the stranger and you, okay, that's very important. Why? Because God created the world in 6 days. The sea and all that's in it. What's the kol, the all, the everything down in the second set? Kol behemtecha, right? Shorcha, Chamorcha, right? Your oxen, your donkey, and all your animals. Over here it's the land, God created the world, and all that was in it. That's the all. Very interesting. Vayanach b'yom ha-shvi, and God rested on the seventh day. Al kein, therefore, beirach Hashem et yom ha-shabbat ve'kadoshei. Therefore, God blessed the seventh day and did sanctify it. So now look at this. They can't get their act together here. Why am I keeping Shabbos after the first Ten Commandments? Because God created the world in 6 days, and on the seventh day He rested. And that makes a lot of sense. Why am I keeping Shabbos after the second set of commandments? Because God took us out of Egypt. You know, sometimes, my wife and I were once discussing this, sometimes you listen to your spouse say something to your children, and you realize there's like a breakdown in logic. Like we have sort of goals, right? The goal is that your children should be in bed so that you can eat your dinner, right? The goal is that the children should get up and get dressed and whatever so that you can get to work. Now, that's really a problem because really the goal is that the children should get up so that we can share time with them before they go to school. And really the goal is that they should get, you know, undressed and pajama and whatever so we can have this special bedtime. And we gotta mix up these goals. How do you know when you're mixing up goals? When you say something to a child that makes no sense, right? Tell a child that makes no sense, right? Mommy, why do I have to brush my teeth? Because mommy's tired. No, that has nothing to do with brushing your teeth, right? And we do this all the time. So come along to God and say, God, why am I keeping Shabbos? Because you got out of Egypt, and I can picture God saying, no, I took you out of Egypt. You want to ask me? Keep a little Shabbos, right? That's how you know. How come I have to wear this dress? I cook for you and I slave for you and I bought you this dress. That's why you have to wear this dress. I have nothing to do with it, but okay. Same thing. What's going on here? What is the fact? I mean, it's very nice. He took us out of Egypt. I'm very glad he did. You know, life is good. But what does that have to do with Shabbat? So, okay, I will grant you that there is an underlying theme here, that getting out of Egypt could very easily be connected to Shabbat. Do you realize what you're doing? First of all, this is the symbolic approach to mitzvah. You're looking at the symbols. What are my symbols? Egypt, remembering, keeping. I want to know what those really mean. And then you're saying, well, there's got to be some message here. It can't just be that I'm keeping kosher because little piggies have ugly little feet. No, there must be some ethical message. And you're not satisfied with this idea unless you can find some ethical message. And I got to tell you that I'm going to share an idea with you, but everything you've said can be found in the commentaries. And you know what? Even if it couldn't be found in the commentaries, this is how you develop a relationship with a mitzvah. In other words, you're sitting here in a class, and I'll share with you my process and what I come to and what Shabbat means to me. But the most valuable relationship you develop with the mitzvah is your relationship with the mitzvah. So all you have to know is that this exists. And to look at it, and you will discover that you can relate to a mitzvah. So if you sit down one afternoon, 5 weeks from now, or 10 weeks from now, whatever it is, and you're saying, you know what, this whole Shabbos candle thing, it doesn't make any sense to me. What am I doing? So all you have to do is find what Shabbat candles is, where it appears, or what you think it is, and think about it. If you think that tefillin doesn't make any sense, if you think kashrut doesn't make any sense, if you think that the concept of building a guardrail around your roof, which is a biblical commandment, if you don't understand that or you want to understand it, then all you have to do is analyze it in the same fashion. It's not so difficult. People look at Torah study sometimes and they think like, oh, how am I ever going to get to this mountain? That's the first stage in studying Torah. So I just want you to be aware that that's what you're doing. And having said that, I want to show you something. Because this to me is incredible. Think about this. I got two possibilities. One possibility is I count 6 days, and then I have Shabbat. The second possibility is I have Shabbat, and then I count 6 days. Let me ask you a question. When was man created? Man meaning humanity, right? The sixth day. So, stop and think for a second. Humanity were created, and they didn't know what day it was. They didn't know it was the sixth day. Because they hadn't been around for the first five. So what'd they do? They kept Shabbat. And then they counted 6 days. And they kept another Shabbat. So we think of Shabbat as the seventh day. But Shabbat for man, originally, was really the first day. God had 6 days. And then he had Shabbat. And then he had another 6 days. He, she, it. And then had another Shabbat. So when the Talmud says that there are two possibilities, to count 6 days and then have Shabbat, or to have Shabbat and then count 6 days, what the Talmud is really saying is that there are two possibilities in your celebration of Shabbat. There is the Shabbat of God, and there is the Shabbat of man. Now, what does that mean? Let's think about that for a minute. The first 10 commandments bring me the Shabbat of God. Why do I celebrate Shabbat? Because the world was created in 6 days. And after 6 days, there was Shabbat. How do I relate to the world? The same way that God related to the world in creation. Kol behemtecha, all the animals. There are different groups and different units. And when you look, by the way, at the process of creation, man is not as significant as God. Think about it. God creates everything. He creates the sun and the sky and the stars and the moon, all the fish. It doesn't say he created Frankie fish and Georgie fish. It doesn't say anything about how many different fish there are. It doesn't talk about the creation of sharks. You know, if I would have seen in the Bible and God did create the sharks and the dolphins and the whales, so I wouldn't have a problem with that. I think that makes a lot of sense. And the tadpoles. And I'd give you a whole class on it, a whole sheer. It'd be great.
look how the Bible tells me. Why does the Bible bother to tell me that God created the tadpoles and God created the whales? It should have just said God created the fish. No, the Bible says tadpoles and whales so that I will appreciate every fish and each individual fish, and that the great fish are no greater than the small fish, and the so small fish are less significant than the great. And I give you a great cheer. Of course, the only problem is it's not there. So it's not truth. It's not what I'm supposed to learn from that particular issue. And the same is true for man. Vayivra Elokim et ha'adam, and God created man. It doesn't say God created this guy. The name for the first man, did you ever think about that? The first man doesn't have a name. We call him Adam. But Adam is really the name for all of mankind. In fact, the name of mankind comes from the word Adama, the ground. That's a pretty strange name for the first man. I would think, let's come up with a name for the first guy. Let's call him Creature Who Reaches to the Sky. Right? You ever listen to Native American, Indian-sounding names? Magnificent names. Running Bull. I don't know if I would choose that one. Flying Eagle. Right? Swifter Than Sound Lightning Bolt. You know what I mean? They're great names. Adam. Dirt. Oh, Dirt. I don't know. Maybe his wife named him. I'm not sure. You know? But, I mean, it's such a strange name. And in fact, you see with man that this is part of the whole theme of man. Ki me'afar ata, you are from the earth. Ve'el afar tashuv, and you're going to return to the earth. Right? That's when God says to mankind, I brought you into this world, I'll take you out. That's what it is. Man is not significant, God is significant. When does man become significant? When does creation become significant? Very interesting. When man gives names to the animals. It's not God that gives names to the animals. It's man. In fact, the whole story of the giving of the names to the animals is very strange. You know what? You don't even have to hold your place because you have this sheet. So look at this. This is unbelievable. Okay? Look at Genesis, verse 15. So I'm just going to breeze through this to make a point. If you want to go back, this is an unbelievable story. God takes man and puts him in the Garden of Eden. I'm going to like synopsize. You can follow along in the English, but don't worry if you don't. Right? And he puts him there to guard the Garden of Eden, whatever that means. And he says to him, you can eat from all the trees, don't eat from the tree of knowledge, fine. All of a sudden God says, Lo tov, this is verse 18, Lo tov hayot adam levado, it's not good for man to be alone. Right? Everybody look at me. Right? Now I'm God. And I, as God, say, Lo tov hayot adam levado. It is not good that man is alone. Only place in the Bible we find the phrase lo tov. It's not good, right? So now what should the next verse say? What should the next verse say? And he does create Eve. And they've got this whole weird story. He rips this rib out of Adam. You know, maybe that has to do with some problems in some relationships. I don't know, but okay, right? A lot of deep thought there, but okay. Nope, that's not what happens. Look back in. God says, I'm going to make him a partner. So Vayitzer, so God is created from the land, from the Adama, all the animals and all the birds, and he brings them to man to see, what's he going to call him? It's pretty strange. What do you, what's he going to call him? What do you call him? You made him, you call him. No. Now it's even stranger because it's almost as though God is saying, we must find a partner for this man. So, you know, man kind of waves to the animals. You know, zebra, pretty, but nah, I don't like that, Giraffe, no, just give me neck ache. You know, the elephant, oh God, could you imagine trying to share a bed with an elephant? Forget it, right? And he goes through the whole animal kingdom, right? V'chol asher yikralo, right? And every name that he gives, right, that will be the name. Man names the animal. And he calls them all. And then it says at the end of verse 20, Ula Adam lo matza ezer kenegdo. But for Adam, he didn't find a partner. Now the word ezer kenegdo is a very powerful word. Ezer is to help, lazur. Kenegdo is against him. So that's, you know, I actually mentioned this last course, so I'll give you a break. But at some point, if you're curious as to what this really means, and this is crucial to understanding relationships in Judaism and in general, I think, right? But okay. So he's trying to find a life partner, not a mate. Well, okay. There's a difference between a mate and a life partner. Ezer, Rashi brings a very powerful comment here. Zacha Ezerlo. If a person has merit, if he merits it, then this life partner will be a help to him. Lo zacha kenegdo lehilachem.
then she will be against him in war. In other words, the two terms, Ezer kenegdo, don't seem to fit. Ezer is from Lazor, to help. Kenegdo is against. It seems to mean conflict. So Rashi explains, based on a Medrash, that this is really the potential of a partner. That your partner can be an aid, you can grow from each other. Or your partner can be against you, it can be a war. Rav Riskin once told me that he had a professor, called himself not religious, I don't even know if he was Jewish, but he knew this Rashi, because he once introduced his wife as Mrs. Ezer Kenegdo, right? So, you know, but, never mind, right? But, this is very strange. What, like, you know, it's almost, and then you see this whole story, God comes along and the rib, and he gives it to Adam, and Adam to woman, and then he has to call a wolf. So what's going on here? It's almost as though God says, you know, let's try to find you a mate. And you can't find a good animal? Oh, you can't find a good animal, we'll give you a woman. It's not exactly my perception of a good relationship. It's like, you know, you'd be better off with a good horse. But you know, can't find good horse, take woman, right? It's not exactly my idea of what I would want the Torah to be saying when it... But of course, that's the whole point. See, man has to first understand the number of things before he relates to woman. First of all, man has to be alone. Because man has to appreciate woman. And he has to know what it's like to be without her so that he can learn to appreciate her. He has to recognize that this is a gift, this person who can share his life. It's also interesting to note that man has to be taught that woman and the relationship is fundamentally different. And when you picture this story in the Bible being written and disseminated 3,000 years ago, you understand how significant an idea this was. Woman is not a slave. Woman's not there to be pregnant and barefoot in the kitchen and bring the coffee and tea. That's not woman. That's an animal. Woman is a partner, an equal partner. And the two of you together build a relationship. Now, why did I bring you this whole story? Because it's very interesting that in the process of this whole story, there's one innocuous fact that doesn't seem to be important to the message that I just shared. See, man gives names to the animals. And that doesn't make sense. God created the animals. So God should name them. So what does it mean when I name an animal? What is a name? What's the concept of shame? So I want to tell you what a name is. See, a name is a definition of place, person, or thing. And a name is what allows me to turn chaos into harmony. Right? If I walk into a room and I'm a teacher, and I don't know anybody's name. I remember once, you know, I used to work in Camp Moshavah in the summers. And there would always be some poor slob who had to get them quiet in the dining room. 450, 500 screaming kids. And somebody would be there with or without a microphone saying, "Shug it, shh, everybody be quiet, oh." And this person would gradually, as the week wore on, become hoarser and hoarser and hoarser and hoarser. And I remember once I was sitting in the dining room, it was Shabbat. There was no microphone. They didn't use a microphone on Shabbat. And this person was screaming and yelling and trying to get, and there's 500, 600 people, and nobody's listening. Right? And I couldn't bear it anymore. So I jumped up on a chair, right? And I picked the person who was talking farthest across the room, right? And I said, "John, will you please be quiet?" Everybody was quiet. Why? Because everybody wants to see where John is, who John is, who's talking, what's going on. Because you define the process. So if I walk into a classroom and I'm teaching a class and I don't know anybody, it's chaos. You don't know me and I don't know you. When we have names, then there's harmony. Then we have a relationship. Man has to develop a relationship with the world. As a matter of fact, the word shame is very much, you know, I told you that when God created the world, he created the world by saying. It doesn't say God said let there be light and then made light. It says God said let there be light and there was light. So God's saying, let there be light, was the act of creation. So the word represents always in Hebrew the entire essence. So here's a perfect example. The word shin, the letter, right? The word shame, the letter shin, is all chaos. It's all going up in all different directions. In fact, in the Torah, this is how it's right? It's really like this. It's all, right? The letter mem is perfect harmony. Matter of fact, it's interesting. If you look at an oscilloscope, which is a measurement of sound, shh is the only sound which has no line. It has no sound line. It's just white fuzz. It's all chaos. And mem is the only sound, which is a perfect harmonious line of sound. That's why, by the way, mantra and systems of meditation always use the because it's a harmonious sound. So what I do with the word shame is I bring chaos into harmony. And by the way, vice versa. When the Torah wants to tell me, for example, in the book of Isaiah, right, that I should not lose the harmony or the harmonious relationship that I develop with God based on Torah, you know what the Torah says? When Joshua is in danger of dying, he enters the land of Canaan, they're about to attack the city, I think it's the city of Jericho right at the beginning, I think it might be chapter 8, but I might be wrong, and all of a sudden an angel comes and wants to kill him. What's the whole message there? The angel says, Lo yamush Torat Hashem mipicha. The word of God, of Torah, should not stray from your mouth. Mouth represents what's inside us, right? So lo yamush, that it shouldn't go away, is exactly the opposite of shame. Mush, right, is turning harmony into chaos. And that's why mush is mush, because that's exactly what it is. And you will find that if a word is real, then the essence of that entire word represents everything about that word. I once read a magnificent book, but I can't remember the name. All cultures have in common certain linguistic ideas and sounds and names and forms. And you can know that a form is real and that it's connected culturally to other forms because you will find this congruence. And whenever you study and find these pieces, like the word la in Arabic is lo, right? No. So that O sound represents something negative. In many languages, right? French, Italian. There's something there. And that's what's going on here. Man is developing a sense of harmony with nature. He's giving names to the animals. My relationship with the world is very much a function of my relationship with animals. As a matter of fact, you want to learn something about a people? You can learn a lot about a society by how they treat their animals. It's a very powerful idea. A lot. The Nazis, the SS. If you wanted to be inducted into the SS, when you were inducted in at the beginning of a year's training course, you were given an Alsatian puppy. And this puppy was with you everywhere you went and did everything. Now a year turns a puppy into a dog. And you can imagine, I mean, being trained in the Waffen SS, in the camps and whatever else that they did, must have been a brutal, horrible, psychologically demoralizing, dehumanizing almost experience. The final stage, okay, of the SS guard's training was he was called into the Kampfkommandant's office with his dog, and he was told to break its neck. And they studied how easily he did this. Because if you can cut off that relationship with that animal, then that means that you are obedient. What it means to me is that I judge this person by how he can relate to animals. By the way, it's very interesting. I noticed there was a PLO training book that was being publicized by whoever, I don't know, the ADL, I don't know, whoever was publicizing it. Sort of, especially in the early 80s when there was this big campaign. They had they took 5 to 8 year olds and they trained them. And just frightening pictures of little six-year-olds being trained to fire Uzis on shooting ranges. And there also, one of their initiation ceremonies was that a little boy would have to take a chicken and literally rip its neck off. And I remember thinking to myself, what does that do to a child, to do something like that? So Adam is being told the opposite. Before you enter the world, you have to develop a harmony with nature. So if you look at the first set of commandments, the first set of commandments are the Shabbat of God. And what God gives me. God gives me the animal world. So it just says, Kol Behem Techa, all the animals. It doesn't give them names. It doesn't give them identities. The second set of commandments is my Shabbat. Is what I do with it. So now the animals have names. And yes, your animal resting is a part of your Shabbat. Because Shabbat is not this isolated experience. It's supposed to be a reflection of your relationship with the world. And just like you have to be at harmony with your fellow human being, you have to be at harmony with nature. And there are all sorts of halachot in Shabbat that reflect this.
I'm not allowed to walk. I'm not allowed to ride a horse on Shabbat. You know why I'm not allowed to ride a horse on Shabbat? Unbelievable halacha. Lest I come to a tree, and the Talmud says, what would a horse rider? Now, we can't relate to this, because we don't naturally horse ride, and we don't think of this. But the way the Talmud writes this, you realize this was such a common occurrence that it was just understood. When you would come across a tree and with a horse, what would you do? You'd break off a twig to sort of hit the horse with. It was like a natural activity. Like, you know, they didn't sell leather riding crops. So if somebody would, you know, come to a tree and break off a branch to hit a horse. So the act of breaking off a branch is reaping, is kotzer, is harvesting. It's related to cutting something from the root of its natural growth. Now you can understand that the mystical perception of this idea is incredible. Because first of all, listen, that's a wedding. That's a Jewish wedding. Wait, hang on one second. No, if I see them, I'll tell you to go to the window. But that's part of the beauty of studying here. You can't just be learning Torah and not listening. So that's now your background for learning Torah. Right? We're studying the wedding of God and the Jewish people. So it fits. Right? So, that's the first commandments and the second commandments. And that's, by the way, a reflection of all the different parts of this puzzle. Now, I'm not going to give you all the different pieces of the puzzle, because now you have what to do. Now you have a framework to work with. See how you can fit this in terms of all the different details. But understand that there are two things that I'm trying to do on Shabbat. I'm trying to develop a relationship with God, but I'm also trying to develop a relationship with my fellow human being. And I'm even trying to develop a relationship with my world. How was the Lecha Dodi written? So I told you the Lecha Dodi was written by Rav Shlomo Alkabetz. Shlomo Alkabetz was a mystic, a Kabbalist. And he would go out into the fields. And the Talmud says the people would go out into the fields and greet the Sabbath queen. Now, I remember when my daughter was like 3 years old. And, you know, I would bring her to shul with me on Friday night, right? And we had a very good system, okay? How did I get her to come to shul? Because I wanted her to come and to experience it, but I didn't want it to be a negative. I thought, what a challenge that my child should grow up and think that going to synagogue is a positive experience, and not like, you know, you have to come to synagogue and sit through the rabbi's sermon or whatever it was. So how did I achieve this tremendous educational plateau? Bribery. It was very simple. And every Friday night she would get a treat, or two, or nine, but she would only get them in shul. So she came to shul. And gradually we weaned her onto different kinds of treats, and now she doesn't, you know, she doesn't need a treat. Sometimes I'll give her one, you know, sometimes she won't get it. But, you know, she comes to shul because she likes to dance now. So it's like a different, okay. So I remember we were sitting in shul, right? And she was three, so she was old enough to notice things. And she sees in Lecha Dodi everybody's turning around. So she wants to know why everybody's turning around. What's going on? Abba, how come we're all turning around? Right? And she's like looking to see what everybody's looking at, right? So I thought, well, perhaps I'll share with my 3-year-old daughter an existential idea that we're searching within ourselves and we have to be behind. No, I don't think so, right? So I said, well, we're greeting the Shabbos queen. We're looking for the Shabbos queen. So for weeks afterwards, she would look for the Shabbos queen. Where is it? I don't see it, whatever. I said, you can't see it? You really can't see it? Right? And finally, you know, I said to her, well, maybe you don't have to see it. Maybe you have to feel it. And we got this, whatever. And as a matter of fact, not long ago, I remember we were sitting Friday night, we were talking about something, and she said to me, Abba, you remember when I was 3 and you told me to look for the Shabbos queen? Right? Do you tell Tani that now? Right? So, like, you know, she's like, she's... So, I'm looking to develop, right, now that you've met her, you know that this could happen, right? I'm looking to develop this triad relationship. See, it's like what's going on today in the city of Yerushalayim. And I have to be honest with you, it pains me. It pains me because everybody's right. And nobody can see that everybody else is right. I remember I was once walking. I had a group from this like kiddish group type of group. There was a group from Canada that I mentioned yesterday. There's a group from Canada. And they knew nothing. I mean, as a matter of fact, they were looking to aspire to reach the level where they knew nothing. They knew less than nothing. They really knew so little about Judaism. I don't, God forbid, mean to say that they knew nothing, God forbid, right? But you understand what I'm saying. And it was really a challenge for me, for my background, to spend Shabbat with these kids and to be able to express ideas to people who didn't know that much. So I remember I offered, I would offer like, you know, Shabbat morning or Shabbat afternoon to do different things with people who wanted to. And I would always make it very optional because I'm a big believer in, you know, resting when you need to rest and whatever. So I remember I said, you know, if anyone wants to, I'm going for a walk in Me'er Shearim, Shabbat afternoon. It's beautiful. It's a magnificent place to go for a walk. By the way, if anybody is curious, if you're in the old city and you want to go for a walk and see something beautiful on your own, come talk to me and I'll tell you how you can do that. But, okay. So I said, if anybody wants to come, you know, I'll go for a walk and I'll show you Me'er Shearim. We'll walk. You know, it's beautiful. And so one kid showed up. And, you know, I just happened to be going for a walk 40 minutes out of my way. And so we went for a walk into Me'er Shearim. And when you walk into Me'er Shearim on Shabbat afternoon, it's just, it's like there's a peace that descends on you. I mean, they have these, you know, barriers that are up. And they don't want cars to drive through the neighborhood because, you know, it's Shabbat and they don't want cars driving through the neighborhood. Okay, so I grew up in New York City. Maybe I'm less sensitive to that. But, you know, I could appreciate it's their neighborhood. A person should have a certain feeling on Shabbat. You'll be in a frat, you'll see. There it's not done coercively, it's done cohesively. There are actually families that do drive in Shabbat, but there's sort of a sense people just, you know, I know people even who park their cars outside, but there are no barriers up. But okay. But so there's a certain peace that descends on you, and you see all the children there in the street, and they're playing on Shabbat afternoon, and you can hear Zmirot coming out of the windows, and you know, you can smell, if you go there on Shabbat morning, you can smell the cholent. Oh, unbelievable, right? And so we're walking Shabbat afternoon, and as we come down to Kikar Shabbat, right, and I never really understood why it's called Shabbat Square until this particular story, we see a whole group of kids. It must have been like 40, 50 kids. And they're running through the square. And there's one older guy, like, you know, a 20-year-old, and he's kind of egging him on. And what are they doing? They're playing a game, so I think. And they're screaming, Shabbos, Shabbos, Shabbos! And I think they're playing a great game. Until I see that there's a car that's driving through this street, and all these kids are running after the car, screaming Shabbos. Now, I would like to believe that they were saying, oh, share with us the beauty of Shabbos, etc., but, okay. Now, don't get me wrong here, because we all have our stereotypes. And, you know, chances are the average, whatever, the average person who drives a car through Me'er Shearim on Shabbat knows that that neighborhood, you know, doesn't want them to drive through there. Knows the shortcuts around. It's not such a big deal to drive around. So there's always two sides to a coin. But here I am with a boy who had never experienced Shabbat in Yerushalayim. We're walking through, and I'm telling him, isn't it beautiful, Shabbat, so peaceful, whatever. And I'm thinking, should I say something? Should I not say something? And you know, I have no problem discussing a topic, but you know, I have the 3 hours to discuss it. And I was debating, and they weren't, Baruch Hashem, they weren't throwing rocks, thank God. So, you know, they, in my opinion, now we're dealing with opinion, they weren't really in keeping with the tradition of Shabbat, and they were totally missing the point of Shabbat, but they were 5 years old, but they weren't yet biblically transgressing it. So, okay, right? So, then a kid finds like a half a lemon. There was like a half a lemon on the ground there somewhere. He picks it up, and he chucks it at the car, right? And this guy sees this, and he's trying to figure out what's going on. What's going on, you know? Why are they doing this? So I couldn't not say anything. So I look at the kid and I go, Ma, you know, come here. So all these kids, you know, they're bored, they have nothing to do. They all gather around. And I said to this kid, there was like one guy who was like the ringleader, he was like 7 or 8 years old, right? So he had all the answers, right? So I said to him, you know, what do you do? I said, I could understand if you're running on Shabbat. It's not so simple. Do you run or do you not run? The Talmud tells me that I'm actually supposed to slow down on Shabbat. But okay, that's not an injunction. It's just, and I could understand if you're so involved with Shabbat that you want to share Shabbat. But I don't know if that person's listening to you. I said, but to throw a lemon? I mean, we make a bracha on lemon, right? We make a bracha. We make a shahako. So the kid looks at me and goes, ah, no, we don't make a shahako. Right? A shahako is the blessing that you make on all things, right? We make a borei priya eitz, because a lemon grows on a tree. So I say, no, actually, it's a Talmudic discussion, and don't make the borei priya eitz. We make the shahako because most people don't eat lemons. Therefore, it's not normal to eat them as a function of the tree. So we get into this, like, I'm having this Talmudic discussion with an 8-year-old, right? In the middle of Me'er Shearim. And I remember thinking, you know, and to make my point, I pick up the lemon, right? And I, you know, broke out the inside of it. And I eat it, right? And I make a shako. And these kids look at me and they can't figure it out. And, you know, anyway, we got into a discussion for 5-10 minutes. In the end, you know, I taught him a niggun and we had a whole song and it was whatever, right? Right? But I remember thinking, like, is this what Shabbos is? Now, I want to tell you, if you went to these children's home on a Friday night, you would have the most magnificent experience. The Zmirot are unbelievable. And you can take a little room with barely enough room to breathe and put 12 people around a table so that you can barely squeeze in and put a pot of chulent or soup with a little bit of bread and hardly enough to go around, and you can make a meal fit for a king. So don't misunderstand me. It's magnificent. But if Shabbos afternoon that kid goes out and throws a lemon at a car, then something's missing. My Shabbat can't only be developing a relationship with God. It's got to be developing a relationship with my fellow human being. And that's true with nature as well. And by the way, it's the flip. Because if you remember yesterday, I said, what a great idea. I'll go to the beach. And I'll spend my Shabbat at the beach. And you can develop a magnificent relationship with your fellow human being. And don't get me wrong. God should grant that all people would take one day a week to develop wonderful relationships with their fellow human beings so the world would be a better place. I think God would be happy too. I wouldn't have a problem. But of course, there's still going to be something missing from your Shabbat if you don't use that relationship with your fellow human beings to develop a relationship with God. So that's the challenge of Shabbat. And that's why there's a balance between the two commandments. Having said that, I want to get to one more issue and ask you one more question. Because there's still something I think that we're missing. One little detail which will prove to be so important. Check this out. Okay? I want to show you something in the Siddur. On Shabbat morning, it makes sense that during the prayers on Shabbat, if I'm going to discuss what Shabbat is about, it makes sense that I would quote the Ten Commandments. And in fact, we do this on Shabbat morning. On Shabbat morning, it says, describing Moses and Moses' journey up and back down the mountain. So it says, Ushnei luchot avanim horid biyado. He brought down 2 stone tablets. V'chatuv behem shmirat Shabbat. And it's written in them, you know, to keep Shabbat. Look up at me. Look, 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 look. V'chein katuv b'toratecha. And so it says in your Torah, what's the quote? Give me 2 possibilities without looking. Moshe brought 2 tablets down. Zachor or Shemor. That's what it should say. Say, Moshe brought 2 tablets down. And in them it says Shabbat. And so it says, quote. Now look at the quote. V'shamru b'nei Yisrael to Shabbat. And the Jewish people kept Shabbat. Now this doesn't make sense. It's not the right quote. I mean, I would expect a quote from the Ten Commandments. So I'm not sure, the first Ten Commandments, the second Ten Commandments. But how come this? So now I want to tell you an unbelievable idea. This is an idea that means more to me because I came to it on my own. But then I thought, this is such a great idea. It's got to be that somebody says it better than I do. So I hunted around and I found that Rav Shimshon Feil Hirsch says this. And I want you to know, and I don't tell you this sort of as a, but I tell you this because this is really the challenge. You know, if you can come up with ideas that are magnificent, and then go see who says them, because if you have a magnificent idea, probably somebody says it, but maybe not, then you'll often see the idea that you came up with expressed in a beautiful way, and you'll get more out of the way it's expressed because you thought of it first. So it's brilliant. So, listen to what Rav Shimshon Feil Hirsch says. Tremendous. There's one word here that doesn't make sense. Right? The Jewish people, I'll read you the verse, you tell me what I'm missing. V'shamru b'nei Yisrael to Shabbat. And the Jewish people kept Shabbat. L'dorotam brit olam, forever. What's missing? I'll read it again. V'shamru b'nei Yisrael to Shabbat. And the Jewish people kept Shabbat. L'dorotam brit olam, forever an eternal covenant. What's missing? No, no, no. Now look at the verse as I'm reading it. We're in the second paragraph. Again. V'shamru b'nei Yisrael to Shabbat. And the Jewish people kept Shabbat. Right? L'dorotam brit olam, forever an eternal covenant. Right, I skipped the whole sentence. You know why you didn't even notice that? Because you don't need it. What is that? The Jewish people kept Shabbat. La'asot Shabbat. To make Shabbat. It should say Shamor or Zachor. So I have to tell you first of all, because this was the one detail we left out, what does Shamor mean and what does Zachor mean?
then I can understand what lasso means. Shamor, says the Talmud, are the negative precepts of Shabbat. In other words, don't light a fire. Don't write. Don't ride in a car. Whatever they are. The traditional perspective. The list of don'ts. That's shamor. Guard. Keep. Prevent yourself from doing things which will prove to become obstacles in your relationship to God. Don't distract yourself from the central idea. Remember. Right? And that leads you to the first, which is zachor, which is that it's not enough. It's not enough to have shamor. And it's very interesting that shamor is the second one. It's the second set of commandments. I begin with zachor. What's zachor? Zachor is all the positives of Shabbat. The infusion of positive energy. For example, Talmud says making kiddush. Making kiddush is not a don't. It's a do. You can't have a vacuum. Nature abhors a vacuum. If my Shabbat is only a series of don'ts, if I suck out all the productive energy from my week, then I've got to put something back in. Otherwise, I'm left with nothing. So how do I put something back in? That's the zachor. Oneg Shabbat. Having pleasure, rest on Shabbat. That's part of zachor. Singing on Shabbat. Learning Torah on Shabbat. Relationships with friends and family. The beauty of Shabbat. That's the zachor. Now it's very interesting, you can't have one without the other. Moshe is telling the Jewish people before they enter the land of Israel, it is so easy to get sucked into the world of zachor. Because that's the exciting part. You know? Let's all sit around the table and sing Nigunim. And don't get me wrong, that's wonderful. God should grant that all the people kept the zachor, right? And let's sing Nigunim. And let's learn together. And let's experience the beauty of Shabbat. But I want to tell you something from the traditional perspective. If you only have zachor, if you only have kiddush and singing and challah and wine and friends and family, but you don't have the shamor, you will always be missing something from your Shabbat. And it's a much greater challenge when you think of it to find the beauty in the shamor, to find beauty in not getting into a car. I know for me, I remember I once had a guest. The best example I could think of. I once had a guest for Shabbos. And you know, we don't answer the phone on Shabbos. And I remember a student's guest, and we're having a discussion. And occasionally somebody will call our home, you know, a student who doesn't realize, or somebody from America, different time zone. And we're sitting at lunch, and this person is there, and the phone starts to ring. So I don't pay, it's Shabbos, I don't, you know. And this guy is sitting there, we're having a discussion, he's just becoming more and more visibly uncomfortable, you know. I mean, I remember once I saw a candid camera, right? And they had people sitting in a waiting room, and they had a phone ringing. And they did this whole theme around people answering the phone. Even when they said, listen, you know, just, I'll be right back, do me a favor, don't touch anything, don't answer the phone, don't do whatever, and she walked out. And then the phone starts to ring. Every single one of the people in the waiting room eventually picked up the phone. Now, the skit was set up so that they were coming to something, but they didn't know where they were. In other words, you know, they were answering an interview for a potential job, but they didn't know yet what the name of the institution was, what the address was, where they were sitting. Right? So, you know, someone called up and said, hello. And the guy would say, well, hello, my name is Bernie. They say, okay, well, who is this? What's your position? Or, is this the institute? Well, which institute is it? I wasn't sure it was the right number. Well, I don't know. Well, where is this? Well, I'm not really sure. Well, what do they do there? Well, I don't know. Well, who are you? And the person felt completely ridiculous for answering the phone. And then the person would hang up the phone and would go sit down, and the phone would ring again. And again, the guy would sort of look at the phone, look back, look at the phone, and finally answer the phone, knowing there was absolutely nothing that they could contribute to the phone, right? So this guy is sitting there, and he's sitting at my lunch table, and it's Shabbos. So for me, the phone doesn't exist. And finally he says to me, do you want me to answer it? You know, like, you know, it's my house, he's not gonna, you know, but he just can't. And of course the question is, who rules who? Am I the master of my phone, or is my phone the master of me? You can't have one without the other. They're both a part of your Shabbat. By disconnecting myself from my phone, I allow myself to experience the beauty of Shabbat and develop relationship. And by the way, it's very true in human relationships. I know with my children, occasionally we get out of the house. I took them just last week on Wednesday. I came home, picked up my son,
We went to the park. My daughter met us. We had a couple hours rolling around on the ground. No phones, no pens, no notebooks, no ties, nothing. And you need that. And that's Shabbat. But now comes the Siddur and says, but there's something else. What is this lasot to the Shabbat? What lasot means is that we look at Shabbat as a given. We look at it as a gift. God gives us Shabbat and tells us to keep it. What the Torah is telling me is that it's the Jewish people that have to make Shabbat. What do you make of your Shabbat? And the essence of Shabbat is la'asot et ha-Shabbat. You have to make Shabbat. And I'll give you the best example I can think of. I remember I was on an APC. It was the first time I really ever had to drive on Shabbat. It was really the second time, but it was the first time where I was getting into an armored personnel carrier and doing a patrol on Shabbat. And I had to answer the radio and I had to write down coordinates and I had to use a flashlight and everything you could imagine. And for me, you know, I brought up in a traditional home and we were in the middle of Lebanon. It was tremendously difficult. One of the most difficult things for me about being in Lebanon, and I was there for a while, was that you didn't have Shabbos. You know, you didn't like get 6 days of patrols. Like when you're on training exercises in Israel, the Israeli army stops on Shabbat. The only things the Israeli army does, no maneuvers, no exercise, right? There aren't even leaves granted on Shabbat. If you're in for Shabbos, you're in, and if you're out, you're out, right? Not to say people don't bend the rules, right? But life-threatening activities, patrols on the border, planes in the air, things like that, so those go on. So we're in Lebanon. So you don't take a break. You don't stop doing it, right? So Shabbos is Monday. And I remember it was very difficult. And I realized that my Shabbat was only going to be a function of what I made of it. I didn't have this whole system now to sort of slide into, to come home and to go to synagogue and to come home to a table that was set and, you know, everything else. Because I had to do all these things. And you can make Shabbat wherever you are and whatever you're doing.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.